Now, the rebels in the city of Valenciennes, the other city which had gone into rebellion at the same time as Tournai, were isolated, but they were still hoping for some kind of relief. Their hopes indeed centered on a man by the name of Baron Henry de Brederode, who was an early member of the Confederates, and he was actually an early leader of the Confederate movement itself. Brederode at this time was holed up with a garrison of mercenaries in his castle of Vianen, near the city of Utrecht. Brederode became the protector of the Calvinists and the head of the opposition to the crown. He was advised by a committee of Calvinist merchants and churchmen, and in January of 1567, Brederode and the other Confederates met with the grandees in an effort to broaden their basis of support against the crown. Again, interestingly enough, Orange and his compeers offered no open support to the Confederates. They were really unwilling to move, and were extremely reluctant to move, into open revolt against the crown. Brederode therefore had to act alone. He occupied the city of Antwerp, and he entrenched his forces in a nearby village. There he began assembling troops, and these troops again were paid by the Calvinist churches in the vicinity. The crown was unwilling to wait for this force to grow too large, and instead it struck first. On the 13th of March, 1567, a hand-picked force of 800 soldiers, half of whom had been directly provided by the Count of Egmont himself, which gives us some indication of the position of the grandees at this point, this picked force of soldiers stormed the camp. Brederode himself was, fortunately, away from the camp at the time, but almost none of the rebels in the camp escaped alive. They were all ruthlessly massacred. The Prince of Orange now, just like the Count of Egmont, came over openly onto the side of the crown, and Orange intervened in person, in fact, to prevent the Calvinists in the city of Antwerp from leaving the city to help Brederode's men. The rebellion now began collapsing truly on all fronts. Valenciennes capitulated on the 24th of March, 1567, and the remaining rebel towns quickly followed suit. Even Antwerp itself accepted a garrison on the 13th of April, and the very last rebel outpost fell in early May, 1567. Brederode and the Prince of Orange himself fled quickly to Germany, where the crown forces couldn't reach them. By the middle of May, 1567, the revolt was more or less over. Not only that, but open Calvinist worship in the Habsburg Netherlands was also at an end. The grandees and almost all of the other social elites, aristocrats, high merchants and magistrates in the cities and so on and so forth, had all rallied behind the regent, albeit in many cases somewhat belatedly. It would seem, in other words, that everything had returned to normal. But at just that point, there came an event which was to utterly transform the situation. On the 22nd of August, 1567, after a transalpine march of some 65 days, a Spanish army of 10,000 veterans, headed by the fearsome Duke of Alva, arrived in the city of Brussels. What had happened? Well, even before the news of the revolt reached Spain, Philip II had decided that really sterner measures were going to be necessary in the Netherlands. He had already, in October of 1566, taken a final decision to send an army to the Netherlands, and in November of 1566, he appointed as commander the Duke of Alva. And Alva had been a consistent hardliner. He had always advocated a hard line in the Netherlands, and he saw his mission as basically ensuring that the rebels would not make any trouble ever again. One of the ironies about Alva's expedition to the Netherlands is actually the fact that it was almost never sent at all. It took an awful lot of time to assemble a Spanish army and send it to the Netherlands. The general had to be appointed, the troops, and then the general usually had to be sent to Italy, which was the jump-off point for a Spanish army moving to the Netherlands. The troops had to be brought up, sometimes from southern Italy, perhaps from some other parts of the empire. They would usually be mustered in northern Italy, just south of the Alps. There were always complications with the weather. It was not impossible, but it was certainly difficult to move an army over the Alps in the winter. And even once you had gotten over the Alps, there was actually a long trek ahead of the troops to get them to the Netherlands. It turns out that Spanish military engineers and military planners were pretty good at dealing with this difficulty. They had established a complicated network of supply posts and routes for the troops to follow. It was usually called the Spanish Road. But all of this took time, and as I've mentioned in an earlier lecture, nothing in a Spanish monarchy ever moved very quickly. So what ended up happening was that although Philip had decided, like I mentioned earlier as the fall of 1566, to do something about the Netherlands, and in November of 1566 had actually appointed the Duke of Alva as general for it, it took a long time to get everything ready to go. And in the interval, news began to filter back from the Netherlands that the worst of it was over, that the royal forces were starting to be successful, that people were coming back to the Catholic side. And indeed, there's a kind of an ironic moment. One is often hard-pressed to choose decisive turning points in European history. But there is actually an interesting moment in Spanish history where the Council of State in Spain is kind of caught in a dilemma. They've got partial news back that the rebellion is almost over. They know it's going to be complicated to send an army to go and put down a rebellion and all the attendant suffering that it's going to cause. And they're not sure what to do. And the council actually splits on whether or not the army should in fact be sent at all.